Now you're saying, hey, like, if you guys want to have fun, we
totally
can't let that happen.
Yeah. Yeah,
you got to go to the forest and, like.
You got to go to the forest.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Are we recording on there?
Recording.
Okay. Are we recording? Recording? Yep. Yeah. Yeah. So we can start whenever.
Cool.
Yeah.
So we're here with Eric Kaysen. Welcome to the Hell Money Pod.
Welcome.
Another episode.
Yeah.
Yep. Here with Eric Kaysen. What was the website?
So my website is cryptosovereignty.org.
Okay. Tell us about cryptosovereignty.org.
This has been my personal journey over the last 5 years of exploring the social, political, and philosophical ramifications of Bitcoin. And I'm going to be compiling all of this into a book and that's going to be published by Bitcoin Magazine.
Interesting. Do you have a title for the book yet?
It's going to be Crypto Sovereignty, the Ontology of Bitcoin.
Hell yeah.
Ooh, shit. Ontologies are fraught. Ontologies are real hard. Like, a lot of why the state sucks is because laws suck is they want to apply ontologies to things.
Yes.
And then it's really hard to be like, you know, where do things go in the ontology buckets?
You know? You know, and so my whole approach is that, you know, to me, Bitcoin seems to be fundamentally transforming questions about what it means to be human, and specifically what it means to be human in our world, where we have the internet, we have all of this advanced technology. And so now when we ask ourselves, what does it mean to be a free and self-sovereign individual in the digital age? I think Bitcoin fundamentally redirects that question in a way that's so important, it actually has the potential to transform humanity.
Why does Bitcoin do that? Why is Bitcoin that singular thing that changes the game of sovereignty?
Well, there's like an entire historic and philosophical arc that we can go into this. But from my own readings that I've done through a philosopher, Giorgio Ambigan, he has a series called Homo Sacer. Mm-hmm. And in this philosophical series, Homo Sacer is the Latin word for the sacred man.
Mm.
But what that means is that somebody that can be... sacred is an interesting term in Latin because it can also sort of mean forsaken. And so the idea is that the forsaken man is he who can always be put outside of the law, but they can't be sacrificed. And so the idea is that this is an individual that can always be killed by the state because they've violated some precept. And also they can't be killed in ritualized sacrifices because they're outside of the purview of the gods. So the idea is that Ambigan traced, like, who are these people that are homo sacer throughout human history?
Mm-hmm.
And really kind of the conclusion that he came to is that states, in the way that they're invested in power, they'll always have a situation where they will need to declare a state of emergency to create enemies of themselves because they're naturally going to have people who resist their own power.
Mm-hmm.
And because that fact exists, that there's a state of emergency that can be declared, that can overcome laws, there's always this potentiality for individuals to be placed outside of the law through the state of emergency.
Mm-hmm.
So to me, the 20th century was a story explicitly about that power getting so fucking unhinged that we got a bunch of genocides, but not just any genocides, like the most efficient and the most precise genocides that you could get. You know, like, it's really interesting when you look at the history of the SS and how they developed the killing and how they developed the extermination camps was specifically, there was a few events where essentially they had to kill tens of thousands of people in a few days span. And even these people that are part of Nazi death squads, after killing thousands of people in a day, it started to have a real psychological affect on them.
Mm-hmm.
So Himmler, in all of his beauty, he was worried about his soldiers and was like, well, we can't just have them openly killing all these people. We got to find a way to make it more efficient to kill people.
Right.
So first they started with mobile trucks where they would gas them using the carbon dioxide from the trucks.
Yep.
They found even that wasn't efficient enough. So that's when they started to develop the showers to, you know, shove everybody in, gas them, and to be able to do these mass killings.
Mm-hmm.
So anyway,
it's interesting that it's like both like resource efficiency and time efficiency,
yeah,
but also psychological efficiency, like the minimum impact on the killer. They were trying to minimize the impact per unit of death on the people carrying out the killings.
Yeah, and so like this is essentially the unhinged conclusion that the sovereign gets to through these states of emergency when they feel there is any enemy class that threatens them. And so to me, and also tracing this lineage, I think kind of the more shallow and banal point is that, like, this was about money. Like, Jews were rich people in Germany, and one of the reasons that they were sought out and executed was so that people could steal from them.
Mm.
You know, and one of the more interesting histories that I think of this genocide was that these Jews who were killed in the genocide literally had the gold extracted from their teeth. The SS laundered that money into Switzerland through specifically the bank that was set up by the League of Nations for Germans to repay the French as reparations. So they took this bank, laundered their the gold from the Jews' teeth and, you know, Romas and all the other people that they killed, had this huge stockpile of money at the end of World War II. We went and had the Bretton Woods Convention, and before, and we invited all the different nations to come. The Norwegians wouldn't even come to the convention unless we agreed to explicitly disband that bank and to push the assets out elsewhere. FDR was like, hey, that's cool, we can do that. Have Bretton Woods Convention, get to the end.
Mm-hmm.
FDR is dead, Truman comes to power, and Truman's like, well, we got this like pretty nice bank that's like really efficient, and you know, nothing wrong with it.
Uh-huh.
Just has some sullied money
built
in it, right?
On a like Indian burial ground kind of thing.
Yeah,
you know?
He was like, you know, why don't
we can
make,
fix this old house up?
Why don't we make this bank
the bank.
Bank of International Settlements, what is today the world's largest financial institution? So the International Bank of Settlements is a actual Nazi bank that got its seed funding from the teeth of Jews killed in the Holocaust.
You know, honestly, kind of spooky, you know?
Yeah.
Kind of spooky stuff there.
Hey, perfect for the Hell Money podcast,
absolutely,
right?
100%. Do you believe in karma?
Yes.
And is that like a spiritual belief for you, or is there more of like a practical mechanism? For me, it's spiritual belief, but... like, is that something that you've always... I'm curious about kind of like your spiritual journey and sort of how you come to these conclusions about the way things work. Like, is this... like, I feel like your theses are like philosophical, sort of spiritual, sort of practical as well. Like, yeah. Is karma something that you've like always believed in? Is it kind of like... do you have like a spiritual thesis?
I suppose, but I'm not sure if I could actually articulate
it. I mean, same.
I've always had beliefs in karma, and I think what we call karma is actually just like the resolving mechanism in our world for like how chains of things interact with each other that we don't necessarily understand.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So a bit of the butterfly effect in the world.
It's like a shorthand for like we see the beginning, we see the end, we don't see the exact causal mechanism between them, and we draw this line, which is karma.
Yeah.
But there is this underlying causal mechanism that's just too complicated.
Right.
Yeah. And because it's too complicated, we just dismiss it. Or because we can't see it or understand it directly, again, it's dismissed.
Mm-hmm. Right. It doesn't really fit into like necessarily like a rational framework. But if you observe over, you know, making your Nazi bank the major bank or building on an Indian burial ground or whatever, like if you observe it over time, then you can, yeah, kind of conclude that it's real, I guess.
Yeah. Well, and part of that karmic process is the drifting from truth and the actions that are then created from being untethered from truth.
So karma has to do with truth as well then.
Yeah.
I've never thought about it that way, but that's an interesting... So do you think, like, do you believe in one truth, or like what's your kind of... as a philosophy person?
As philosophy, yeah. I do think that there is an objective capital T truth.
Okay.
You know, I think that the particular pursuit towards that is of the utmost importance. Like, I think one of the key problems with modernity is that we have misinterpreted truth as correctness. So it's simple. The truth is the right answer. And I believe that that's fundamentally mistaken. Because what the truth is actually is the pursuit towards it and the uncovering of how we get to that answer. And so it's much more about the journey towards the truth. And so essentially by us misinterpreting truth as correctness, it's narrowed our field so explicitly that like if we don't get the immediate answer for something, we don't believe that to, like that's how we conceptualize the truth. And like this can be traced all the way back to Plato's presentation of the idea and how we have translated the idea as being that appearance of the image of the idea as opposed to the unveiling of what the idea is through the correct way of understanding
it. So truth is more of like a process than like a destination.
It is the process of uncovering how we get to that,
right.
Which is relational to the idea of proof of work.
Mm.
You know, because like we can only actually get to the truth through our own logical process if we can, you know, just like how your math teacher in sixth grade, he's like, well, that doesn't fucking count. You just wrote six. I want to see how you're adding the two threes together.
Right.
You know, and there we go. That's your proof of work there.
Mm-hmm.
And so one of the key problems specifically in modernity is instead of us having this chain of truth of work, we've actually turned to various appendages of, in my opinion, authoritarianism.
Yeah.
And not to necessarily say that this is a decree that's given to us, but the idea of the medical doctor saying, well, I'm a doctor, so I know more about your body than you do.
Right.
You know, whereas... that may be true, but he should also go, well, I'm a doctor. Here's all the proof of work that I've done so I can tell you that this thing is how it is.
Yeah, right. And also just sort of the explanation of like, I'm a doctor and so I can take you through explaining this to you in a way that like in theory you could understand if you had enough expertise or knowledge or whatever. Mm-hmm. Like solving the 3 + 3 = 6 math problem in front of you.
Yeah, and hopefully like if I'm not doing the math or showing my own work, they should be able to help me through that.
Right, right.
But I think so frequently, and you know, as we've seen play out in our own world for as long as we can remember, but more extremely in recent days, is like, you know, we have a Federal Reserve that's literally printing out money, giving it to the largest and the most powerful institutions. They're like, well, this is good for you. And mm-hmm. like, well, and we're the authorities because we're economists and we know more about how money works than you do. You know, and like, I very much believe that they absolutely believe that.
Yeah.
But this sort of authority as truth creates legitimacy is like what the fundamental problem is. And that's also the conclusion that Hobbes came to in De Civ, which was, you know, really kind of the first political theory presented about 500 years ago. He surmised the power of the sovereign as it is not truth, but it is authority that the sovereign has that creates legitimacy. And so I think we have now entered into a phase with the internet where we're inverting that entirely. We're saying, no, actually, authority no longer has any bearer of legitimacy. Mm-hmm. It's truth itself.
It is interesting. I have thought that like perception of legitimacy for most people of authority comes from authority's power. That is the source of why people view authority as legitimate, is because it has power. Not like, I think if the government wasn't able to like enforce laws, wasn't able to have like a monopoly on violence, people would see it as less authoritative, as less of an authority, right? Less legitimate. And Bitcoin is interesting because it's like a sphere where the government can't exercise its authority, right? The monetary sphere has always been a place where the government can exercise authority, and now that authority is being removed, and I think it inherently delegitimizes the state, right? Because if people view authority as being the source of like power as being the source of the state's authority, if it loses power in such an important sphere, then that must like curtail its authority in or its legitimacy in the eyes of the people.
Yeah, I mean it's very similar to, you know, the parable of the insane emperor with no clothes. You know, like he parades around the city totally naked and nobody can say anything because they're terrified of what could happen to them. But the radical truth is right in front of us. He's naked, he's crazy, you know, we can't say anything because he'll kill us. And then ironically, it's the children of all people that go, hey, he's naked. Jeez, like, what's he doing? Mm-hmm. You know? And that and this whole idea that literally a child can see what the actual truth of the matter is.
Right.
But as adults, like, we get so embedded in these places of listening to the authority that when, you know, somebody does tell us, hey, you need to, you know, for example, you need to tolerate us printing out money and give it to these biggest banks because this is the right thing to do so that we can help stimulate the economy correctly. Again, totally believe that they think that that is the right and the correct thing. And as the people in power, they have a right to do that. And so, you know, furthermore, they can approach people and go, well, we're, you know, we're the authority. We're right. And I'd say this actually relates back to the way that the ancient Romans saw power, is that there were two distinct methods of power. There's the idea of auctoris, which is authority, that which actually creates the ability for the state to say, hey, this is what you do. And then there was postatus, which they just saw as raw power, the actual physical ability to be able to do something. Mm. And what I think is really interesting about Bitcoin is like it doesn't have any auctoris. There's no authority about it whatsoever.
Right.
It was entirely embedded in its own power structure. You know, so like, look, the state, you're free to try to change Bitcoin as much as you want. Have at it. Have fun. Maybe you'll find something great for us. But I don't think you'll be able to do it because the problem is you guys rely on structures of truth that is about your power and the authority, which that doesn't work here anymore. Mm-hmm. This is a totally different realm where that structure and form of power doesn't operate. And this relates back to some of my work at Crypto Sovereignty with, you know, there's the quote from Satoshi where he says, you know, we have an opportunity to, I'm going to butcher the hell out of this quote.
But like paraphrasing.
We have an opportunity to win a new territory of freedom.
Yeah.
You know, and we can see that these P2P networks are good at not being able to have their head cut off.
Mm-hmm.
To me, when I read that, that's relational to a Foucault quote from Truth and Power, where he talks about, essentially in political theory, we continue to be obsessed with the idea of the sovereign and law and prohibition,
mm-hmm.
and we haven't had the ability to cut off the king's head yet in political theory.
Mm.
To me, this is what Bitcoin does, is it unapologetically decapitates the sovereign and says no longer do we need to have a single individual rule over the rest of us and make decisions for us. We can make decisions together for ourselves about how we choose to run our network and how we utilize that. And then the final portion of that is because of how he utilized cryptography and sort of allows for us to abscond in the internet, this physical component of how the state can show up and really extol violence on somebody because of that, we literally have an ability to abscond into bits now to mm-hmm. avoid that.
Right. It's such an important like sphere of exit, right? It's like, I mean, almost the only greater sphere of exit would be if we could have actual like physical spaces of exit, you mm-hmm. know, like actual like territories, right? But money is such a important technology that it like ranks up there. Like, I think it's like communication, technology, and then space and property. And like, what else is there, you know? Those are the things. And so Bitcoin is a major, major component.
Yeah. And I'd go even further with that. You know, like and this is why I'm so interested in the philosophical part is that like, it goes beyond just money because we're talking about wealth and value. Mm-hmm. And these are fundamentally distinct and different ideas that has gotten lumped in with money over time. And this is one of the reasons why people are so grossly misinformed about what's going on here. Because when we talk to them about what Bitcoin offers them, they just see it as like another asset or a stock or something like
right.
that. Like they don't understand that this is radically different from anything else they've ever encountered because it is a form of property that's more property than property's ever been.
Right.
You know, it's literally a formula of knowledge. And so, you know, like Gigi talks about how like all of the Bitcoin already exists. It just hasn't been discovered. You know, and so when you have a private key that owns Bitcoin, anybody's welcome to go find those 12 words. Problem is that it's like trying to find a fucking atom in the universe. You're just not going to do it.
Yeah. So, okay, can you explain what you mean by the difference between money and wealth?
Like, sure. And like, this can go really deep, and I've wrote about it too, because this is the weird shit that I like. So first of all, like the etymological translation of the word wealth is first derived from commonwealth, which is like the idea of the common wheel, but it's also the derivative of the form of how we get commonwealth. And then if we take from the Latin translation of res publica, which is like the public thing, which is what we also called the state, I think that translation of res publica, the state, into commonwealth is very particular because what it's trying to say is like what the law itself is, what the state itself is, it's the values that we hold in common together.
Okay.
That is the commonwealth, mm-hmm. is our legal system, our property. And one of the reasons why it operated so well is that the idea of protecting property was a fundamental dictum of the state. They didn't have the ability to radically come in and make declarations of states of emergency in order to steal your state. So I think one of these ideas is trying to think of wealth as this true value that we can hold for ourselves and have totally self-sovereign. And I think particularly when we contrast Bitcoin against everything that has came before,
mm-hmm.
there's nothing nearly as radical or as powerful, we'll see how much gets picked up on that. There's nothing more radical or powerful than this idea of that with just 12 words, I can be self-sovereign.
Mm-hmm.
Every other form of property, there's always a methodology to be able to physically extract it from somebody if they don't want to.
Right.
And so to me, this is one of the most important things is this reflection on the idea of how is Bitcoin different from prior forms of property, money, and wealth? You know, and then I think money is an even more pernicious idea because of the way that we've mixed this in with being wealth when we readily know that fiat money is something that's freely made up by governments. And so at the end of the day, when you have someone who's on the board of governors saying that they can create infinite money, well, how is it possible for that to actually be a form of wealth if it's infinite?
Mm-hmm.
You know, and so these are some of the deeper issues that I think teasing out is pretty helpful to start to try to look at how Bitcoin is fundamentally different from other assets, if you will.
Yeah, I think this is something that's really hard for me to communicate to people that don't know anything about Bitcoin or crypto or haven't really thought very deeply about what money is like. I think a lot of people just sort of think, well, money is fake. And they're sort of right, because money is fake, you know, with like the fiat system where it is infinite and it can be printed forever. And they're like, well, it's this sort of game that people can play. And like, I don't want to play that game, basically. And I don't blame them for not wanting to play that game. But I think then it's this like hurdle of getting through that and saying, okay, well, what actually is money like with Bitcoin, you know?
Well, and I'd emphasize, I don't want to play that game either.
Right.
But guess what? That game's going to play you if you don't play it.
Right.
Totally.
And that's one of the great problems is that we don't have, like, if this was just about us voting for the right money or whatever, great. You know, like, we can figure that out, whatever. But that's not what this is about at all. Mm-hmm. It's about that there's a small elite group of people who are very powerful who control that money for their own explicit purposes. And as Daniel Webster warned us 2 centuries ago, they want to be good masters who rule rightfully and righteously.
Mm-hmm.
But let's be clear that they want to be masters first and foremost. You know? And this is to me, this is the very problem that we have now gone into is that, and this again is part of the authoritarian structure, is that people go, well, you know, they're economists, they went to Harvard Business School, they studied all this stuff, they worked at, you know, all these big banks, so they must know the most about money and the best way to protect it. And the sad truth is for them and their friends. But
yeah.
That's
yeah.
Different
I mean, the,
for you.
The orthodox mainstream economics has bothered me for a long time. I remember in community college, I took a microecon class, mm-hmm. and a macroecon class. And the difference between them was so incredibly stark. Microecon was this like very concrete, very useful thing, just like personal incentives and utility and stuff like that, explaining like behaviors of individuals and like small market dynamics in like a very, very reasonable way. Mm-hmm. And then macro is like balance of payments between states and relies essentially on like all these models and all these like incredibly, incredibly complicated models and like theories about like business cycles and like booms and busts. And it's sort of like plausible, but it's all shaped by the incentives of the people who the economists are like courting, right? Like economists come up with stories and they try to sell them to like states and politicians and powerful people, and the states powerful people and politicians accept the economic stories that benefit them. And that's where like mainstream Keynesian inflationary economics comes from, is because it's like flattering the priors and like giving power to like elites. They don't want to hear like a don't print money story, right? They want to hear money printing is fine, like you can do the crazy interventions in the economy and it's good, you should do that.
Yeah. And I mean, like this goes to show that like, you know, what we call economists, what we call economics now is purely modern monetary theory.
Yeah.
You know, like it has completely disposed of any heterodoxical ideas around economics. And this is one of the reasons why Austrian economics have essentially been dejected from any normal schools of economics at this point in time, is because they're saying a bunch of stuff that they don't like.
Yeah,
you know,
exactly.
Like it's not advantageous to the structure of the state to have people in institutions of education saying, hey, you shouldn't give the power of money to government. That's really bad because they're going to make a lot of really terrible stuff happen. You know, and I think that this is one of the other things about being a Bitcoiner is that, and this is, I had already been pretty well informed about economics, but I hadn't read much on Austrian economics. So when I encountered Bitcoin, I was like, how is this thing even working? Like, this doesn't make any sense.
Yeah. Did you see it was like a Chinese economist on some news show, and he said, like, people asked him, like, what happens if we adopt Bitcoin? And he said, we're all going to die.
Oh, I did.
Literally. He literally was like, we are all going to die. Because he's, like, fully bought into Keynesian economics. He's like, no, like, you know, the boom and bust cycle will, like, it's just terrible. Like, we're all going to die. Like, these people believe this, right? So how does Bitcoin function, like, in that worldview? Like, they just have no way of fitting into their worldview.
Let them burn. Yeah, like, I'm sorry. Like, I'm not interested in participating in saving the current system. You know, like politically, I'm an anarchist. Like, mm-hmm. I think statism was a great thing for the 300, 500 years that we had it. We now have the internet. Like, this is such an insane, radical, powerful, crazy thing.
Uh-huh.
Like, I wouldn't have met my wife. I wouldn't have met you guys. I wouldn't have met most of my friends. I wouldn't have gotten to Bitcoin. And it's all because of this magical connection,
a bunch of wires that we strung everywhere.
Yeah, I have a friend who likes to point out that like these are like physical wires that actually like link us all up to each other.
You should check out the map of submarine cables.
Oh, yeah.
It's just, like, wacky. You can see these crazy maps, and there's, like, dozens and dozens of cables that link the East Coast to Europe and, like, Europe to, or, like, link the West Coast to Japan. And then you can look at New Zealand, and you can be like, wow, I see why the internet is slow in New Zealand. They got, like, one piddly little wire. Yeah.
In terms of, like, I don't know, comparing the internet to something like an agricultural revolution or, like, the invention of the wheel or, like, these kind of things, like, where do you place the internet in terms of, like, human advancement?
I would say the internet is the single most important thing that humanity has done up until now.
I agree, but I can't tell if I just have bias because I'm living in it.
Yeah,
you know?
Well, I'm not sure. I hope I have extracted my own bias, but I don't think that that's true at all.
We're totally unbiased here. This is a 100% bias-free zone.
There you go.
This podcast, exactly. Zero bias.
But I do actually think that Bitcoin's even more monumental than the internet because of the problem that it solves. Mm. And I think this is like where my work starts to get really fucking crazy, is I also think that like, we are very much careening towards, like, the apocalypse. Like, we're entering into the eschaton where, like, essentially law starts to fall apart.
Mm-hmm. Shit's going to get immantized soon,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, we are amortizing the eschaton,
yeah.
You know? And, like, it's that, as crazy as that sounds, like, look at how powerful AI technology is.
Aren't we
is
not
right
supposed to immantize the eschaton? Isn't
well, that's
that the
what
advice?
He told us, but I don't, you know, I'm feeling differently from him.
Okay,
so
damn, all right.
Well, it was,
immantize it.
Was it Bucky that said that?
I don't remember.
I think it was. But anyways, I love that quote. So I think we need to amortize the eschaton because we have this tool now, which, you know, I have a great essay called Messianic Bitcoin.
Messianic Bitcoin, that's sovereign.
Yeah.
What's the website again?
So my website's Crypto Sovereignty.
CryptoSovereignty.org, right? Yeah. That's where the essay is.
Yes. And you know, and in this I pretty much say, look, like, it's not messianic because, like, it doesn't fly down and rescue us as some god, but there's a great quote from Walter Benjamin that the Messiah doesn't arrive as the Redeemer. He arrives as the vanquisher of the Antichrist.
Mm.
And like, it's pretty clear to me what's going on with CBDCs. Like, this is evil. Like, this is wrong. They want to monitor and surveil everything that all transactions, everything's people's doing. Like,
fight of CBDCs versus Bitcoin really has a revelations kind of flair to it.
It does.
You know what I mean?
Yeah. Like, this sounds fucking crazy. I totally get that this sounds bananas, but it's like what it is. Like, I can't change that.
Yeah.
Listen, that's accepted here on Hell Money Podcast. This is what we do here.
Good. You're doing good roping me back in when I drift off.
No, so. I love it.
I always go off into the... It's funny when I'm writing, I'll, like, drift off into these, like, you know, go way off into left field. And I'm like, I don't think I can recover this. I just, like, drifted way off.
I'm glad that you're talking about 12 words. Because a lot of people think, you know, 24 words, more secure, maybe you even need 36 words, but that's like inflation. 12 words gives you all the
it's true.
All well, the entropy you need.
You just do your 12 words with a passphrase on top of me. There are mixed feelings about that, but, you know, I think a passphrase can be helpful if you're thoughtful about it.
Yeah,
but,
yeah, yeah. You know. I'm curious about, we sort of talked about our, like, personal, like, shitcoin Bitcoin arcs. What's your, like, Bitcoin arc, and how did you avoid shitcoinery? Was there a point where you were close to succumbing to shitcoinery and then you pulled back from the brink?
Unfortunately, just because you're asking the question directly, like, I did shitcoin early on, you know, like, and I think it's important to realize, like, there wasn't a dialogue about shitcoins or not shitcoins. Like, we very much had to go through the ICO boom in order to develop a dialogue about shitcoins versus Bitcoin. Because to be clear, at this point in time, there's still a bunch of what would be considered shitcoins, you know, Litecoin, Purecoin, Feathercoin, all that stuff. Mm-hmm. But because the community was so small at this point in time, there wasn't a tension between that.
Sure. Mm-hmm.
So me and Rizzo were talking about this earlier. And, like, it was only through the block size wars and realizing how different our philosophies
right.
were about our
right.
approach to this that, one, it started to generate some bad blood between different characters. And in that as well, we realized that our philosophical ideals for what we wanted for Bitcoin were different. And so I think those two things combined then help serve to create a new dialogue of, okay, Bitcoin is doing this more revolutionary, anarchist, plebeian sort of pursuit. And ETH and other shitcoins can go off and do more of the VC world computer.
Mm-hmm.
Every fantasy that we have about what the internet could do, we can do with these other things.
Yeah,
whereas Bitcoin will focus on the money.
And the community had to develop that kind of immune response. Right. Like, I mean, I think that there was a period, like you said, where there wasn't such a division between Bitcoin and altcoins. And I think that people within Bitcoin just slowly realized that you couldn't allow that within Bitcoin spaces, that it would just be like a corrupting influence, you know? It'd be distracting, people would always be pitching their own shitcoins, and so we developed this like immune response of like, no, Bitcoin only, right? Like that we have these like Bitcoin only spaces, which are rare. Like I host the SF Bitcoin Developers meetup, and I looked at early events, and SF Bitcoin Developers, like back in 2014-15, had Ethereum events. Mm-hmm. Before it went full Bitcoin only.
Yeah.
Yeah. And it's kind of like the, you know, the quote, like every institution that's not explicitly right wing will eventually become left wing. every institution that is not explicitly Bitcoin only will eventually bend the knee to shitcoinery, will become a degenerate hive of shitcoinery, scum and villainy.
Yeah. And like for me watching the development of that process, like the thing that I specifically got burned on was Tezos.
Oh, no,
like,
shit. Okay, why Tezos?
I believe, so first of all, when they launched their white paper, it was done pseudonymously. They rolled that back pretty quick. Same thing, like you could just put Bitcoin into the Tezos contract, get Tezos immediately, so it wasn't KYC'd from the start.
Oh, really? How did that work? How did the exchange work?
They literally had a set amount. They gave you an address, sent money to it.
Oh, so it was like basically a burn, like
yeah, it was like
an address on Bitcoin that you would send it
yeah,
to.
It oh, yeah, it wasn't a burn address though, because like Tezos, right, like, yeah. Tezos still has like the fourth or fifth largest holdings of like all Bitcoin. It's
oh,
pretty
wow,
crazy.
Yeah.
But anyway, you know, I saw the project. Proof of stake was still an interesting thing. I hadn't worked all the way out through either, so mm-hmm. like that was another part of the dialogue. Yeah. And then for me, when they backdoor KYC'd everybody, I realized, like, I was like, oh, shit, like, of course they're going to be able to do this. And I felt pretty silly, too, because, like, I'd believed all of this stuff naively about, mm-hmm. you know, the Ethereum, the world computer, and that we can use ICOs to do all kinds of crazy shit. And the Tezos thing for me personally was where, you know, it, to me, that was the board to the face where I was like, oh, shit, like, this is all bullshit. Mm-hmm. Like, they're... This is crypto, but completely extricated of any cryptography, which mm-hmm. is one of the things that I think is super funny at this point in time, is that like this word crypto now represents this sort of lobotomized, I don't even know what it actually is. At
yeah,
this
crypto
point in time.
is a disdainful word. Like I use it to mean like everything that's not Bitcoin.
Yeah, well, and like what I like the most about that is that like the word literally means secret, and that, like the word has encrypted its own meaning to these very people that are
crypto,
presenting.
Crypto.
Yeah,
crypto has become cryptic.
Exactly, and I joke that like these guys are actually the first and foremost crypto anarchists because like mm-hmm. they don't even fucking understand.
Yeah,
this
yeah, they don't even understand their own technology.
Doing, you know, and
you're not a real cryptographer if you understand what you're doing, just by the etymology of the word. You know,
well, and I have an essay called "The Encrypted Meaning of Crypto," where mm-hmm. it, you know, it's about this whole culture of VC guys that talk about crypto, but like their project doesn't have any decentralization. Mm-hmm. That like everything's been done and generated in the open, so like we can $5 wrench attack anybody who's involved with the project and mm-hmm. easily circumnavigate their cryptography.
Yeah,
and the whole point is just getting back to like cryptography literally means the artistry of secrecy, mm-hmm. and if we extricate the art from that, we're not left with anything meaningful anymore.
Right. Right.
So, and to me, that's one of the major problems that's happened in the field is that when people talk about crypto, it's all this VC bullshit as yeah. opposed to anything that's related to cryptography.
Yeah. Yeah. I think the turning point for me was it was probably sometime in like 2016, 17, where I was always pretty open-minded. I would like read, I would like see something and I'd be like, oh, I wonder if it works. Mm-hmm. And then I'd read the white paper. And then I'd be like, wow, like, I don't think this works at all. And then I'd see something else and I'd be like, oh, that's interesting. Like, I wonder if it works. And I'd read the white paper and I'd be like, wow, this has serious problems. Like, mm-hmm. this is just going to fall apart. And then at a certain point, I was like, yeah, I guess I'm just not going to read any more white papers. I guess when I hear about new things, I'm going to assume that they like don't work. Like, people are going to have to really be talking about it for a long time. And that's been a pretty good heuristic. Like, that's worked. That's served me well. Like,
absolutely. Yeah. And I think it's a bit sad that then you also get all these crypto bros who come out and they're like, why are you Bitcoiners all toxic? Like, I don't understand why you're meanies. And it's like, look, dude, like we've seen 200 projects come through and 200 of them fucking scams.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
like, I don't see why you get to come in and just tell us that you're not a scam and we take you at your word.
Right.
You know, yeah. And this plays right back to what we saw with Sam Bankman-Fried, with him literally 2 months ago talking about how some exchanges were insolvent. And it yeah. turns out that he was that very exchange, you know?
What a fall from grace, man. What a, like just immediate, you know, plummeting. Totally yeah. fucked. Empire on fire.
I like, woke up and I read that Kevin O'Leary lost $1 billion in that. And I was like, God damn, today is a good day. You know? And, like, the reason I have a lot of resentment in me at this point in time about this VC culture around what we're trying to build here, and mm-hmm. that we keep getting these guys who believe that because they, you know, went to the right Ivy League schools, that they, you know, worked at the right hedge fund, made friends with the right people, that they're somehow entitled to telling us what actually is and isn't of value.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And I'm deeply frustrated about that, because this is a difficult enough dialogue with normie people to start with. And mm-hmm. so when we talk about Bitcoin and then somebody comes in, well, yeah, like, here's my shitcoin too, you're confusing people.
Yeah,
and
absolutely.
It's really, really frustrating because... And for me, I want to be clear, like, I'm not fucking interested in making money. Like, it's a cool side thing that happens with this, but what I'm interested in about is about caring for money in a way that makes sure that my grandchildren are going to have a system that is actually operable in a meaningful way.
Yeah.
And this is our one shot to do that. You know, and again, getting back to the Eschaton
the one,
stuff.
The one shot thing is, like, really scary, but I think it's true. Like, mm-hmm. I mean, there is something that distinguishes Bitcoin from everything else, and if Bitcoin falls, like, we are fucked. Like, nothing is going to replace it. Nothing will credibly replace Bitcoin. We're not going to have, like, a Bitcoin 2. It all just, like, that's the Tower of Babel, like, falling and, like, scattering the tongues to the lands, like, forever. Like, we're boned.
Yeah, well, and, like, it's funny because, like, I sort of see, like, that's what crypto could become, is like the Tower of Babel falling, the spread of languages everywhere, and mm-hmm. now nobody can actually get any value out of anything because we're all talking in these tongues that make it right. misunderstandable to one another.
Yeah.
You know, and again, it's scary, but like CBC, central bank digital currencies are coming. Like, that is on the docket. We will have that. It is unavoidable.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and the real question is, if that is implemented, do we get a Chinese-style social credit system here in the United States? And how does that change and affect our culture?
Not exactly Chinese-style. It'll be a weird, like, public-private partnership thing, right?
You're right. We'll have our own corporatist American
slant
to it.
Yeah. It'll be like the meta social credit score.
Exactly. You know, and like, and this should terrify everybody because, like, and again, like, with the sort of technology that we're dealing with, I think it's really important to emphasize that, like, if this thing captures us, like, there's no fucking way out. Like, the technology is too powerful. Like, it's when I look at how powerful AI surveillance has become in the last 5 years, or, like, originally when it came, like, when the pandemic was going on, everybody started wearing masks, I was like, this is great. It's going to, like, totally fucking break facial recognition AI.
Right.
It just enhanced fucking gate recognition AI to the point where even if you got a mask
gate
on,
recognition, like how people walk,
you know,
shit.
Yeah, and so, like, this is the kind of stuff that had me realize, like, oh shit, like, this stuff is getting so powerful that if we don't meaningfully encrypt and blind it now, like, it's just gonna have its clamps on us totally.
Yeah,
and to me, that's what Bitcoin represents, is it's this spear of destiny that we can use to fucking blind the apparatus and make it clear that you weren't allowed to look at us in our private homes anyways.
Would you describe yourself as an, like, apocalyptic, utopian, or both? Because I feel like the things that you say are, you're sort of like, I find this in myself too. Like, I feel like I have sort of this apocalyptic vision of what's coming, but then I have this sort of utopian kind of hope in Bitcoin, and the two are, like, intertwined. And so, like, there's certain element, like, it sounds like, you know, the way you talk about things, you kind of feel like shit's gonna hit the fan, it's coming, it's already happening. Like, is your vision more apocalyptic or optimistic, utopian, or is it sort of like, we'll see?
You get to the utopia through the apocalypse.
Right.
And so, like, I think a lot of this superfluous stuff needs to go away. You know, like, I don't think it is a value add for humanity on a whole to have all of the consumer shit that we have.
Right. And also, we didn't even mention we're at Pacific Bitcoin in LA.
Oh, yeah, right. We're in LA at Pacific Bitcoin.
Yeah, we're in the heart of,
Santa Monica,
consumerism.
You know,
the machine. I always get really weirded out when I'm, like, in urban environments because, like, everything just,
you're free range, you know?
Yeah. Like, I'm, like, wandering out in the forest most of the time. So, like, all of these, like, hard edges and shit kind of weird me out.
I have a friend who's obsessed with that. He's like, you can't just be looking at things that are square. You can't be in, like, square rooms with your square phones and shit.
Wow.
You need to be out, like, doing things like surfing, like, interacting with chaotic, like, unpredictable shapes.
I love that. That's yeah. very true. That was me yesterday when we were on the plane. I was untangling a ball of yarn, and
I was just like Casey freaking out. I
was like,
"Can
I help? I need to get
this
I,
is
like,
too
please,
chaotic."
No,
like,
and I was like,
"You're not doing it systematically enough," and you're just like, oh,
"I was
know,
like, there's no, the, you know, the only way out is through. I just have to untangle this yarn and just see, you know,
did
where
you,
the
like,
next
really
knot is."
Need this yarn for something?
I'm making. I'm you know.
She's making.
I'm making sleeves.
Okay.
Crocheting something, but yeah, it was a tangled ball of yarn. In case he couldn't handle the chaos of that, and I was sort of just like slowly iterating through it, and he kept like literally, you kept trying to like.
I was helping. I helped a little.
But it was a good metaphor, I think, of yes, you know, the only way out is through. You kind of have to just like face the chaos sometimes in order
yeah,
to get
well,
the...
and like, I get all the stuff's really dark, but like through that darkness, we like find other people who yeah. like also see it and want to change it. And to me, like, that's what Bitcoin is. It's literally the shilling point of everybody who sees all of the darkness.
The shilling point?
Yeah, the shilling point. Like as in, because you know that...
a shilling point is
well,
a shelling point.
I'm sorry. Yeah, I get it. I have this problem of I
it
read...
It is both a shilling point
well,
and a shelling point.
It is true. It is true. But a shelling point. I have this problem of reading different names and like I pronounce them in my head incorrectly.
Yeah, yeah. Well, the more you
and
read, the
I just,
worse...
Like, right. put that out there.
The worse your pronunciation, it just means you read a lot.
Yeah, yeah. yeah. It's a good thing. It's a good thing.
I appreciate that way of cleaning that up for me, but I'll just take the L there. But anyway, you know, like this is the point that we all came to mm-hmm. to realize that there are other people who meaningfully care about money.
Yeah.
And that's like another interesting double entendre. Like, of all of people in the world, like, we care about money the most, you know, and not in a greedy, we want to gather up as many units of it, but like, we actually have an agape towards it, in that we want to see.
Agape is one of like the Greek like
yeah,
words for
it's
love.
It's like a love, but it's like a love for humanity. It's a love that's greater than a romantic love,
mm-hmm.
you know, and that it's only through that sort of care towards money that we can then pass that on to future generations and posterity in a meaningful way. And again, I feel very strongly that if we don't do it now, there is no way to escape from it. And frankly, like, I can't face my children in 20 years and be like, so dad, like, when they implemented central bank digital currencies, like, you were just like, I got my $200 free dollars. Like, my kids now live in a panopticon, but that's fine. You know, and like, that's what's going to happen. I guarantee the way that they will release central bank digital currencies is they're going to give people free money.
For
yeah,
sure.
Oh,
100%. Yeah, 100%. Yeah, it's probably, it might even be more like subtle than that. Like, for example, like, if you use the CBDC, you don't need to file your taxes anymore. It's just done for you and taken out of your account.
Like,
right?
What an incredible incentive. I don't have to pay my taxes anymore.
Right. Like, you don't need to figure it. They just take it out of your paycheck automatically, like yeah. they do in every other country. Like, the government makes so many things painful and unpleasant that in order to incentivize people, they don't even need to give them free money. They just need to, like, remove some of the painful unpleasantries that they add.
That,
you know? It's like TSA pre-check, right? Where, like, you, like, pay money to get back to the way that it was before everything got so fucked up by 9/11. You know? And you're like, oh, this is great. I get to go through this line faster that, like, they created.
I mean, it goes to show the sort of Stockholm syndrome that
yeah.
we live with.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. It's crazy to me that people just accept this encroaching, just increase in complexity, increase in rules. I had to get like a very, I literally got an injection, like a medical injection. This is not me like doing drugs or whatever. But like,
yeah,
there was,
whatever,
it was
cool.
like, there was like, I had to fill out all these papers. There were like five or six people involved in the whole process. It must have cost literally like 20 times. Like the actual cost of like maybe like 100 or like 1,000 times the actual cost of getting the injection. And like, people just think it's normal. Like, every increase in like inefficiency and complexity, right? Airport lines, like bureaucracy, like the like labor code, people accept it, right? It becomes the new normal.
Well, and what we were saying about, you know, truth and authority earlier is the same. Like, this is
yeah.
the same thing playing
right.
out. People
actually,
go, well, like, this is just how it has
yeah,
to
yeah,
be.
Yeah, well, and actually, it's the authority's ability to force us to follow these crazy rules that it probably increases their legitimacy.
Well, I think, mm-hmm. I don't know exactly. I'm not familiar with, like, the thing you were describing earlier with, like, authoritarian power versus, like, true power. Whatever. I can't remember. You had two
Auctoris
words.
Auctoris versus Postatus.
Right. I'm not exactly, like, maybe I'm misinterpreting it here. But I think, like, part of it is that people don't feel they don't feel connected with true power. And so they mistake, like, authoritarian power for what power. Like, they don't feel connected to their own personal power or to, like, what true power really looks like or feels like. in real life. And so they sort of just defer to like authority because they need something to be powerful and they don't really feel it in themselves.
Absolutely. And this also goes back to the same authority thing, because it's saying, look, how dare you try to think for yourself and make decisions mm-hmm. on your own without us?
Yeah.
You know, like, we are the ones that are the purveyors of truth, and you must listen to us if you want to be safe and secure. You can go be in the dangerous Hobbesian world where everyone's at war with everybody else. And it turns out, like, that's just another fucking lie that they tell us to keep us scared and afraid and alone. And this is all about, in my opinion, like, this is what modernity is about. It's keeping people weak, inauthentic, shallow, thoughtless, scared.
Yeah.
Because those are people that you can easily control, that are pliable, that aren't going to fight back. And we're at the long chain of this happening for generations.
Yeah.
You know, and so I think now and this is why the world is in the state that it's in, is that, you know, like, I frequently have the experience of trying to go deep with people to talk about this stuff and think, and like, they don't want to do it.
I know.
It's too
story of my life.
You know, and like, and it really hurts me. You know, like, I feel really frustrated and angry because I'm like, this is the most important stuff, and like, you don't want to look at it because it makes you uncomfortable. Like, you just want to go watch some sports ball instead. You know, like, it hurts me and it upsets me because. And I would say also, though, you know, for every 10 you approach with that, if there's one who hooks, it makes it worth it.
Yeah.
But to me, and again, this is why Bitcoin is so hard, is because we have to ask for ourselves to think for ourselves.
Yeah.
You know, I was on Breedlove's show maybe a year ago, and we had a great dialogue about Immanuel Kant's. He has a very short essay called What is the Enlightenment?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And in it, it's beautiful. He's such an incredible writer. But in it, he says, if I can surmise the Enlightenment into a single phrase, all that it is to have the courage to think for yourself.
Mm-hmm.
It's not about listening to the priest on who to pray to, or the taxman to who to pray, or anybody else. It is about simply having the courage to think for yourself and to speak that out loud.
Mm.
And I think that that's what's so radically removed from our society today, is we're not even welcome to try to do that and present it thoughtfully.
Yeah. We had actually an optimistic moment when we flew in yesterday through LAX. We were on the LAX is like a shuttle bus that they take you from LAX to like where you get picked up by like Ubers or whatever. And we were in the shuttle, and Casey and another girl that we were with, we were all loudly talking about the vaccine.
Mm-hmm.
Nothing even that crazy, but just, you know, just sort of like having open dialogue about it that you wouldn't ordinarily see, because dialogue is so stunted about that topic. And there's a guy that was sitting near us that I could tell was listening to our conversation that was wearing scrubs. Like, he was like a nurse or something. And I was like, uh-oh, like, no, like, this could go really badly. And then we started talking about 9/11, and I was like, I don't want to talk about 9/11 on this airport shuttle bus, whatever. We get off the shuttle bus and the guy comes up and he's like, hey, sorry, like, I couldn't help but eavesdrop. And like, I was like, uh-oh, like, oh no, we're gonna whatever be told off by this guy. And he was like, no, like, actually, like, whatever. He kind of gave his, like, theory about COVID that ended up being very... He just basically said, like, everyone that I treated that
everyone,
died was
everyone
overweight.
Who died of COVID in the many emergency rooms
that he said he treated hundreds of people.
BMIs
and they were all
over 20.
Yeah. So like, he was like, that's the narrative that you're not hearing, blah, blah, blah. And he was like, yeah, I didn't get vaccinated for a long time. Then I ended up having to, blah, blah, blah. And he was like, and look up Building 7. Have a great rest of your day. And it was this like very like optimistic moment where I was like, wow, I really thought, like, you know, when I was seeing him sort of like overhear our conversation and like intently listening, I was like, uh-oh, like, we're going to have this we're having this conversation too publicly, was sort of my like anxiety about it. It's mm-hmm. like, you know, we weren't even saying anything that crazy, but it's just so... We're so discouraged from even like questioning or talking about these kind of things, about like certain topics, and like to just have that conversation very publicly and just have some dude come up to us and just give his like random theory about it as well and be like, peace, have a great weekend. It was like, I don't know, as you said, like for every 10 people that don't want to talk about it, there is like one person who does. And I think like maybe that number is growing over time. Maybe it's shrinking over time. Yeah. But like,
I wonder what that
there are those people.
I wonder what that ratio is, because Bitcoin does demand... It like, in order to take the sovereignty that Bitcoin is offering, it does require some amount of personal responsibility and personal education. And so I wonder what percentage of people are actually capable of taking that. And also, could Bitcoiners essentially in the long run become the new elites, right? People who are able to, through personal responsibility and like being able to exit systems and control their own wealth, become elites, control more and more resources, etc.
I mean, the term elite doesn't jibe with me very well.
I know, I was I had a visceral reaction to
baggage,
that.
But I mean, I think it's more than that. I think it, I would use more of the word of leadership. You know, like we, like to me, the political structure at this point in time is insane. Like it's pretty clear to me that like the president of the United States probably has dementia. You know, like there's been public things that have been, and like we all just act like it's totally normal. And this has all gotten so dangerous of that, like, you simply speaking your truth out in the world mm-hmm. makes you feel an anxiety about there being a danger.
Yeah.
When the truth is that by us having those open dialogues, we start to generate something. Like, I bet that guy felt great hearing that from you guys.
Exactly.
You
that know? Was, yeah. yeah Everyone totally. Felt amazing walking away from that conversation.
Well, and the same thing of what we're doing with Bitcoin and the way that we keep rolling over this question again and again about, you know, what is money? What is value? What is mm-hmm. wealth? Like, how do we protect these things? How do we make sure that they work into the future? Like, this is all part of a very, very important dialogue that feeds back into itself, you know? And it's really extraordinary to think that, you know, 10 years into Bitcoin, there's this great conference going on. Price is at like an all-time low for the year,
yeah,
you know?
Let's go.
Like, and like most people are just kind of like, oh, well, that's too bad. But like, meanwhile, like you look over in shitcoin land, they're like, oh, yeah, yeah, like everything's burning.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Like,
yeah.
We're all going to die.
My friends are like, you know, I'm into Bitcoin or texting me, are like, how do you feel about crypto? And I'm like, I feel fine. Like, nothing really changed. Bitcoin go up, Bitcoin go down, you know?
Yeah. You know, and like that's, again, that's also part of kind of the culture that Bitcoiners have helped create for themselves. But I'm convinced more than anything that what's allowing for us to start implementing the things that are going to change anything is that we're actually thinking for ourselves again.
Mm-hmm.
Instead of when the government's coming and saying, no, you can't have these things, this is bad, we're saying, no, actually, like, looking at the chain of history, it looks like it's really important to have a self-sovereign wealth that yeah. nobody can take for any reason.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because, like, again, like, what would you do if you were any number of the people who were killed throughout the 20th century because they were in the wrong group of people? Whether it was a Roma, a Jew, a Herotian, a Cambodian, whoever, there have always, well, I don't want to say always, but the 20th century is a great testimony. You know, we can see it every decade. There's a new genocide somewhere, and it's explicitly a story of a government that gets out of control, and then it wants to start killing people because, you know, it has the state of emergency and the right to do that. And the question mm-hmm. Is that...
Whoa.
Bombs are going to start falling.
Yeah.
That's it, guys. We said too much.
Yeah, they're coming for me. You know, to me, the real question is, when we get to that place that the law itself represents lawlessness, how are you going to actually protect yourself and your family? You know, even if it's the slimmest possible chance, I think it's really important for people to consider, what are you actually going to do if for some reason, by some association, you become labeled an enemy combatant,
mm-hmm.
a terrorist? How are you actually going to protect yourself and your family?
Mm-hmm.
You know, and to me, the example I always give to normies is like the fact that Edward Snowden used Bitcoin to pay for the servers to get the information out there should really emphasize how important this technology is
mm-hmm.
to people that the state don't like.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm curious, so we read your article, The Political, this morning, and you brought up, you know, God is dead, that mm-hmm. kind of idea, which I talk about a lot, and I'm very curious. One of the conversations we just had, I think on our last episode, was sort of related, but, you know, I feel like this kind of, like, new atheism, like, just sort of this new era of people sort of being disillusioned by organized religion and, like, no longer believing in God, and that being something that people can't bring back, that like there's no reviving that in people for whom like God is dead.
Mm-hmm.
And the question that I sort of have is like, is that a permanent state or does something new emerge? Is something new already emerging? Or like, you know, is there a new iteration of, I guess, like faith that emerges like in this God is dead, like end of history sort of post era? I'm curious just, yeah, kind of your thoughts on that topic in general.
Yeah. So I think, first of all, you know, God is dead, made famous from Nietzsche. And
right.
I think it was Amorphism 125 in his writings. But in this, you know, he says God is dead. And it's the madman who actually says it. And I think that that's actually a really important thing to emphasize. Because if it's a madman who's talking about God's dead, then like we don't actually need to listen to him because he's mistaken.
Mm-hmm.
But through Heidegger explains Nietzsche in a way that was really helpful to me, of that by Nietzsche saying God is dead, he's not necessarily meaning that the idea of who God is has been eviscerated. It's more about the development and advancement of technology and science and the way that we know and understand the world. That's what destroyed God, because there's no longer any mystery that can be had.
Mm.
And so Heidegger's explanation of Nietzsche is that Nietzsche essentially was able to get us to the end of Western philosophy as we understand it.
Right.
And now there's an opening for something to come after that, but we don't necessarily know what that is.
Mm-hmm.
And to me, what I'm seeing going on is through the acceptance of the nihilism that God is dead, is that, and this is a Heideggerian idea, is that what we need to actually come to realize is that because we live in the darkness of nihilism, we have finally reached an apexal point where God actually needs us more than we need God.
Huh.
And
okay.
So part of that is, and again, part of the crazy shit I believe about Bitcoin is like, this is part of our production of something that is God-like. And the one of the reasons
is
why
Bitcoin
is like—
Is Bitcoin the new God?
That's what I—
Bitcoin is the— It's not Bitcoin is the new God. It's that cryptography is the last God.
Mm.
And it's the last God because if we're actually executing cryptography appropriately, it means that these secrets are secure forever. And now it means that there is a space of harboring for man individually to choose that which he keeps secret to himself.
Mm.
You know, and what I think is really interesting is Heidegger being really big on this idea of the pursuit towards truth is unveiling or uncovering.
Right, the process.
Well, that's the same thing of Bitcoin in reverse, is that it's about covering your private key to keep it secure as a secret.
Mm.
You know, and this is essentially like secrets are part of this ontological makeup of the universe that allows for us to empower the mystery of the universe.
In a way, like, secrets are the domain of God, right?
Yes.
Like, God has secrets. God can't be understood. This is like a fundamental characteristic of God in almost all traditions.
God operates in mysterious ways.
Mysterious ways, yeah. Right. Cryptic ways, one could even say.
There you go.
And so it actually kind of gives that power to individuals, right? Allows people to claim a space of secrecy, right?
Yep. And particularly in our day and age, being able to protect that secret, which you can have your wealth imbued into now. And this is one of those ironic twists of like that only becomes this extraordinary and radical power, like in an advanced globalized capitalist system where nihilism has collapsed God so thoroughly that money itself has become the new God of this materialistic system.
Right.
And again, like, it's this sort of sick irony of that, like, the most superfluous, shallow bullshit thing, money, like, ends up actually being, like, the greatest and the most exposing capacity for humanity to recover its own humanity.
Mm.
And it's not because of the money itself, it's because of the care of money and making sure that it does what it's supposed to do as a form of storage of wealth.
Mm. Right, right. Yeah, I love that. I'm curious also, like, what was your personal journey to getting into philosophy and, like, writing and all this kind of stuff?
These were all questions compelled by Bitcoin.
Yeah.
Like, oh, really? This was not something that you were into before Bitcoin?
No. Like,
wow.
The
I assume that you were, like, a philosophy major or something, that you've been, like, just a big-ass philosophy nerd for your whole life.
The joke that I always like to tell it, and it's not a joke because it's true, is that, like, God literally, like, made me lose my mind in, like, a really extreme way. He was, like... Yeah, I'm like, this is in 2013. He's like, hey, like, you should, like, take out a bunch of, like, unsecured loans on credit cards at really high interest and just, like, buy all the Bitcoin as much as you possibly can.
Uh-huh.
And I was like, okay. You know? And, like, meanwhile, like,
sorry, God spoke to me.
Yeah, and, like, I had family members and friends come to me and be like, we're really worried about you. Like, we think that you're actually having a manic episode and that you're losing it, which I think I was.
Mm-hmm.
And they're like, we're concerned that you're going to destroy yourself. And it was funny because I had a great conversation with my wife where, you know, I was like pretty anxious and worried about this. She was like, look, she was like, I think you are manic. She was like, I do think that this could end really poorly. She was like, but you know what? If you don't do this, you will have to work at the bank for the rest of your life and you will hate it and you'll probably kill yourself.
Wife sounds pretty based.
Yeah.
She's super based. And like, she also knows my own struggles with depression and other things. And she was like, but like, if you do this and it does work out, like, you'll actually be free.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
She was like, so I get it's a huge risk, but you seem to think what you want about it. So I'll support you and I hope it works out. And if it doesn't, you know, we're already broke, so what does it matter?
Right. You can't be negative broke. That's some fiat made up bullshit.
Well, anyway,
you can't have negative money. Can't have negative Bitcoin.
You know, it worked out well. I also happened to, you know, be an early Coinbase employee, which was helpful as well. You know, so God rewards me in this way. And now I'm at this place where I'm like, well, how the fuck did this even work? What, like, why does this thing operate how it does? Uh-huh. Like, why does it seem to be able to maintain its own oath to itself in a way that no institution...
I love that, maintaining its own oath to itself.
Yeah,
that's a
beautiful
turn of phrase.
Yeah.
Well, that's what it's doing, you know? The literal handshake that machines make at that initial communication, like, that is based upon a performative semantic action that must have truth in it. Like, the machines have no ability whatsoever to lie.
All they can do is swear oaths to each other.
Well, and through swearing that oath, they have to, like, they don't have the semantic ability to be able to lie to one another. Mm-hmm. And so inside of that ability, there's now this really powerful function. And this was the original hook for me. I was like, how does it do this? And so I started, you know, doing some Google foo. Mm-hmm. And I was like, okay, there's this guy, Giorgio Ambigan. He has a book called The Sacrament of Language, the Archaeology of the Oath.
Mm-hmm.
I get this book. Like, it's the most esoteric stuff I've ever read. This guy has, you know, like 15 citations in a page. He's like listing random Latin and Greek words. I'm like, way over my head.
Mm-hmm.
But I have to know. So I dig in deeper. And it's been this huge process of oscillating back and forth of where, like, I want to rip my hair out. And I'm like, what the fuck is he saying? This is insane. Like, I don't understand any of this. Mm-hmm. And then I throw the book aside. And 10 minutes later, I come back and I'm like, what is he trying to say? Come on, figure this out. And it's been a very difficult journey, but it's been 100% compelled by Bitcoin, because I think what's going on is a deeply philosophical process.
Mm-hmm.
But because it's coming at this in such a strange way, nobody's been able to think about it in that way.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And it's funny because it's only recently that I've found that more people have gotten much more interested in sort of these esoteric ideas that are revolving around it. So
what are things in the space, people, ideas, projects that other people might not know about that you find particularly interesting?
So a good friend of mine, like, I think Frost, using the Frost protocol.
Right. For people who don't know, Frost is a threshold signature scheme where currently we have, where you can essentially do an N of K signature where you need N keys out of K keys to sign. But it looks like one public key and one signature on chain.
Yep.
These threshold multisigs are indistinguishable from a normal one public key, one signature Taproot output. With Taproot, we can currently do M of M or N of N, where you have like 10 keys, 10 people need to sign, but we can't do like 3 of 10 and make that look like a single signature. Huh. And so, what is it? That's
a fantastic explanation, by the way. Much better than I could have done.
That's what
we
keep him around for.
Why do you think Frost is so interesting?
Because now, not only do we get signature aggregation, but there starts to become possibilities like doing lightning with multi-sig in a meaningful way where you can still have a single signer using that K key.
Mm, interesting.
You know, I'm like, there are all these sort of fringe developments. And also, there's another place that, and this is part of a larger dialogue of, I still want to, you know, lambast shitcoiners for what they are, but there have been great advancements in development in cryptography from shitcoiners.
Right. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So, like, there's a number of shitcoin projects that are making advancements in cryptography that I find really interesting. Like, ZK rollups are a really interesting technology.
Right. Yeah, it's interesting to me. Like, I mean, so I've been, you know, Ethereum scaling roadmap has been all over the place. Like, all sorts of, like, random shit, right? They had, like, first they were going to do sharding, and then they were going to do Plasma, and then Plasma is like weird, so there's like Plasma Coin and Plasma Cash and all these different variations of Plasma, and then optimistic rollups, which are like pretty bad, and now finally they've gone on to ZK rollups, and I think ZK rollups are something that Bitcoiners should pay attention to, because they've finally found an actual interesting scaling technology that has interesting applications for Bitcoin, right? All this shit like sharding, plasma cash, those were all incredible like dead ends that were just terrible ideas. But that doesn't mean that they're always going to produce terrible ideas. And ZK rollups are an interesting idea with serious potential for Bitcoin.
And this is one of the things why, you know, like I wish there was some way to like make peace amongst crypto people as a, like to essentially say, look, like if you can honor that Bitcoin is like essentially like
it's like the Jews and non-Jews. It's like, listen, as long as you follow the seven Noahide laws, like you're good. You don't need to be Jewish, but like we're chill. You know, we're Bitcoiners. We're God's chosen people, and just don't worship false idols. Like recognize our God and we're good, you know?
I guess really what I'm saying is I'm a Bitcoin imperialist. If they will allow bend the knee. There you go.
Yeah.
You know? But yeah, so like I think that there's a lot of those projects in the space. In all honesty, like I'm really excited about the amount of social dialogue that's going on around different non-technical aspects.
Yeah.
You know, and that because like I think it's really important to include non-technical people and to meet them at where they're at.
Mm-hmm.
In addition to, like, I also think it's important to not allow for devs to put themselves in a place where, like, they're always superior to other people.
Uh-huh.
Because, like, that's part of what my big burn at Coinbase was that because we were support people, we were seen as being non-technical. And because we were non-technical, we were seen as not contributing.
Right, mm-hmm.
But the deepest irony is that, like, we contributed technically more than anybody else because we saw where they fucked up the code.
I mean,
one of the main problems I had with it was like I'd always go to them and they'd be like, well, I'm big wig developer who knows the most. So like, how could you correct me?
The stories that you tell about Coinbase, I think, are incredibly interesting because so people don't make good things by like noodling really hard and then making the whole thing. And then it just works. People make good things that work by making a shitty MVP, getting it out there and iterating on it, seeing what people like about it, seeing what works, seeing what doesn't work. And it sounds like from your stories that there was this sort of like insulated dev culture that didn't have to interface with customers, didn't have to interface with the real world, and just had ideas about how the system was supposed to work. And you were there on the front lines, essentially doing customer support, dealing with people who had like specific complaints about the system. And the devs like didn't want to hear it. They were like, no, the system, the system doesn't work that way. It's not supposed to work that way. Mm-hmm. Right. But you can only build good, complicated things by getting that very specific feedback and like constantly iterating and constantly paying attention to it.
Yeah. And you know, it was difficult because like things would come up, we'd give them feedback. They would give the explanation for why that can't change. We'd gather more information, come back, show how it's a bigger problem now. Uh-huh. If we don't deal with it, it'll get more extreme.
Right.
You know, and in some really unfortunate cases, it was literally like, all right, like, let you know, I'm like, on the support team, we had to be like, we're just going to let this thing break, mm-hmm. and it's going to cost who knows how much money. And when they see that everything's on fire, then they'll fix it. And for me, like, having watched that process of capital destruction a number of times, like, it was really painful. Because not only, like, was seeing the company do that, but, like, we were actively hurting customers.
Mm-hmm.
Because we wouldn't solve issues where maybe they were losing money. Maybe we were thoughtless about how we set something up. And in all honesty, like what made Coinbase successful is like they were the only game in town that had ACH rails for about 18 months.
Wow.
There was some.
When were those 18 months? When was that period?
This was probably like late 2013 up to the beginning of 2015 or so.
Okay. Wow.
You know, and that's one of the reasons why. When I was joining, I knew that they were going to be successful because ACH rails were, you know, imperative to be able to get work done.
And that they were doing that, I believe that they weren't exactly telling their banking partners what was going on. Like the ACH rails weren't really aware that they were a Bitcoin exchange, right?
It was a bit opaque. Like I wasn't involved on that side, so I couldn't say. But I do know that there was a lot of tension that we had with our banking partner then. We got a new banking partner out of that who ended up sort of doing that in the space. You know, but with that being said, you know, I worked with a lot of super brilliant people who are very passionate, who are still out making great contributions in the ecosystem. And I think that, like, Coinbase from 2013 to 2017 when I was there, like, I think it was pretty magical. It was a small team, passionate people, committed. It just turns out that, like, as more and more money came in, there was a bunch of people that wanted to go do that, and that's fine. And then there was a bunch of hardcore kind of cypherpunk anarchists who wanted to do their thing, and they went off and did that.
Yeah.
And overall, like, it It was just like a very special time to get to share and contribute in that, because we all got that there was something pretty important going on, but I don't think anybody knew or understood how big it was going to get. And I think particularly if you visited any of us today with a time machine in 2015, was like, do you know, like, this is what's going on, and there's all this stuff, they go, holy shit, really? Wow. Incredible.
Yeah. It's insane to me how much, like, how much power banking and payment processors have, like, continually. Like, it's just incredible. Like, they really determine what are, like, permitted activities. They, you know, Tumblr dropping pornography from their platform entirely because of payment processors and, like, advertisers. Right. There's all these, like, incredible hidden forces, and banking continues to be a huge force about, like, what is permitted and what isn't permitted. And it was never intended to be this, like, political censorious force, yet we've somehow created it anyways.
Well, and, like, this is sort of the interesting irony of modernity, is that, like, everything that we call politics today, like, it doesn't actually influence in anything that is the political.
Right.
Right.
You know? And so, like, this is a really dangerous thing, because, like, we just had an election, mm-hmm. and quite frankly, like, I don't expect anything to change in any meaningful way.
No.
You know? And, like,
if you made a list of who is in power, it would not, if you made a list of, like, the 200 people who have the most power in the world, it would not really be politicians, because they're just the tip of this, like, iceberg, mm-hmm. right? That is just the final, you know, the final outcome of the process, and not the actual process that controls power.
Yeah. And I mean, like, you know, looking at what monetary history is, like, this is a story that's literally as old as humanity. Like, money has always been inherently political. It's only with the perniciousness of fiat that we've been able to be manipulated in such a place that, you know, like, we believe the Keynesian dialogue that has been given to us.
Mm-hmm.
That it's really interesting, because, like, if you read economic history from the 1930s, like, Irving Fisher's idea of how debt deflation would play out, like, was pretty interesting and legitimate, and was a great countenance to Keynesian ideals, but it was too painful for them to not be able to have political control over money, particularly seeing what happened, you know, with the gold crisis in 1907 that made the Federal Reserve. And so, like, money has always been an inherently political thing, and that's why Bitcoin's so important, is it finally severs that relationship. Because, you know, at its most extreme, that politics of money is the representation of war. Like, you have a bunch of stuff that I want. I'm going to use a knife to get it from you. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm like, that's a really dirty and scary idea. But, like, that's how it actually plays out at the very end. And so now that we have a money that, like, we can secure with different methodologies that, like, yeah, maybe you can cause physical harm to me. You're not going to get my money, though. You know, like, that changes stuff in a really radical way.
Right.
And it opens up a new concourse of the political. Because also, like, I've had
Bitcoin is, like, the first political thing that's happened in, like, decades.
Literally.
Yeah. You know, like, I would say there were maybe harborings of political... actually, I guess you're right. Yeah. And part of it is because it engages in this totally new and different strategy for having politics. Because we've been so obsessed with this classic idea of the sovereign and having somebody be able to give authoritarian decrees or to be able to enforce laws or be able to use violence to either constitute law or be able to create other methodologies of it. Mm-hmm. So the fact that we're now engaging in this totally different field of, frankly, just thought that allows for us to exit from this system is the most powerful thing, in my opinion.
I agree.
Are we at time?
I think so. Yeah, we're at like 1:13, so that's perfect. Yeah, we should wrap it up. But yeah, is there anything? I guess we talked about your book a little bit at the beginning, but do you want to talk a little bit more about your book, when people can get it, and all that sort of stuff?
I have no idea when people could get it.
Okay.
Hopefully sometime next year. I'm wrapping up the manuscript. All of the articles are articles that I've published online before.
Mm-hmm.
I've just gone through and kind of tried to stitch them together more, because I've really realized for myself, this is sort of the foundational work of a constellation of different ideas that leads into, like, my next big piece of work, which is trying to create much more of, like, a unified philosophical approach to what's happening with Bitcoin, which to me, like, this is all about the correct way of thinking about how money and wealth should be stored and secure. And, like, and I think a number of us have already had this process of that, like, essentially there's an inductive technique of knowledge that we're all having, that at some point in time there's like a snap that happens. And like that snap, in my opinion, like is the event that appropriates us from just being normal people into Bitcoiners. And now like we've essentially been taken over by the mind virus that is Bitcoin to serve its purpose.
We've got pretty bad Bitcoin brainworms.
Exactly. You know, and so like we have literally been appropriated for that process. And this all relates to Heidegger's philosophy, his later piece of work. It was called The Event. And it's really a series of notes that he never published in his lifetime, but he had this idea of that when philosophy finally got put in its place of being sort of the maxim for what all things can function from logically, that like that's actually an event in the concourse of humanity that rescues us from nihilism because it is the return to truth from the world of darkness. And he calls it the triumphant return of being.
Wow, that's great.
And so I think Bitcoin is the event that allows for humanity to rise up and to triumphantly return. And he uses this word being a lot, and he has one spelling is B-E-I-N-G, but the other is a more ancient form, B-E-Y-N-G. And so that form of being is about like our higher form of self that's called when we have been appropriated by the event that returns us to the truth that is logic executed into the world.
Wow. Revelation shit for sure.
Yes. So
I think that's the final word.
Yeah, I love that. Thank you so much for joining us.
It's been great.
We'll see you guys next. We'll have a couple more interviews, I think, for Pacific Bitcoin. But
For now, signing off.
Thanks.
Thank you, everybody.
Bye.
Awesome.
Nice. So are you guys just like popping into the conference?